Hello, I'm John Wilson. Thank you for downloading this edition of Master Tapes from BBC Radio 4. Hello and welcome to Master Tapes. That's David Crosby and his band playing live for our audience at the BBC Maida Vale Studios. David's here to take us back to the making of his 1971 debut solo album, to discuss his work in the 1960s with the Byrds, and his ongoing musical odyssey with what they call the Mothership, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young.
Wooden ships on the water, very free and easy. The way it's supposed to be. 8 miles high. And when you touch down, you'll find that it's stranger than known.
Just some of the timeless classics that David Crosby has helped create. In the first part of this edition, Cros talked about how in 1971 he came to make his first solo record, how he started out with the Byrds before teaming up with Stephen Stills, Graham Nash and Neil Young to form the world's first supergroup, and how sex and drugs were always there alongside the rock and roll. The A-side is there to listen to and download at the Master Tapes page on the Radio 4 website. Now we flip to the B-side for more chat and music from David Crosby and questions from our studio audience here at Maida Vale. David, before we get those questions, I've got one for you. How important has your audience been to you over the years? Do you play for them? Do you write for them? Or do you always write for yourself, do you think?
I just write what comes, but they're tremendously important. Playing live is all about establishing a chemistry with an audience. And sometimes, if you're in the wrong building, the wrong time, or the sound isn't right, you know, sometimes we're playing in what we call blimp hangers.
Enormidomes.
Yeah, enormidomes. I'm going to steal that. It's very tricky, and it's all about us being able to entangle you in our emotions and take you on a voyage. So the audience is crucial. Really crucial.
Interesting. The reason I asked that is I talked to Neil Young recently, and he said he only ever plays for himself. Often the audience will hate what I'm doing. I don't care. I play it anyway.
Yes.
At which point David Crosby diplomatically zips his mouth,
yes.
And we move on, and we get our first question. The question is from Jamie Putnam.
Lyrically, the album is quite dark, rueful and insular. Do you see it as a postscript to the death of the hippie ideals, refocusing inwards as opposed to the sort of all-embracing spirit that was in the mid to late 60s?
That was very well put. No. When we made that one, we still believed that we could turn it around, that we could end the war, that we could change the slow disintegration of the United States of America, and that we could make things right. We believed it.
And I should just drop in a quick recap. In the first part of this program, you were talking about how you came to make your album, If I Could Only Remember My Name, in 1971. Many friends dropping into the studio, great fraternal atmosphere, everybody chucking in ideas. You were also reeling from a sense of grief after the death of your girlfriend at the time, and you were taking a break from Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. And Jamie there says he thinks it's a dark album. Listening back to it now, do you get a sense of darkness, of insularity?
No. Not at all. Listen to songs like Camel Pious Hide. Nobody had done that before, where you did songs where you just used your voice as a horn stack and there were no words. And the vibe that you get off of those songs is pretty up. It's not a downer album, I don't think. Truthfully, when you write a song and sing it and put it out, it's like folding up a glider and throwing it out of the window of a high-rise. You have no idea where it's going to land, and you don't know what anybody's going to think about what you wrote on it. They could interpret it as the end of the world or a message from God or such tripe. one of the great things about music is it's endlessly interpretable. I like that about it. I like it that you imagine in your head what's going on, and you get to create your own world with that song. I think that's a good thing.
Next question is from Graham Kay, who says he's an artist from Balham in South London. Graham.
There were a lot of big egos involved with If I Could Only Remember My Name. Did that cause any problems? And if so, did you have a designated ego wrangler?
No.
Just to say the big names that Graham's referring to, you had Graham Nash in there, Neil Young was on the record, and members of Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane and many of the big names from the West Coast scene at the time.
Yeah. Everybody was there for the music, and it wasn't competitive at all. It was very generous to each other. It was a very warm thing. It wasn't an ego fest at all. And I had the biggest one there anyway.
So a very different atmosphere to a regular Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young recording session.
You had to point that out, didn't you? You know, our recording sessions have been actually pretty damn good. The toughest thing for us when we were making Deja Vu is that sometimes I would come to the studio and sit on the floor and cry. And that's not really encouraging. If you make good enough music, then there's a bonding that takes place. And when you do it right, the whole becomes greater than the sum of the parts. And you know it when it happens. You get chills. And I don't think ego is really a great motivator. I think giving to something bigger than yourself is a great motivator.
Next question comes from Anthony Lawrence. Anthony.
Hello, David.
Hi.
Knowing your father was in the entertainment world, how did that impact on your creativity and musical development? Was there encouragement, just acceptance, or was he against your involvement in the world of music?
He was never against it. I thought, because my dad did make a lot of films and was...
He was a cinematographer. We should just explain
cinematographer.
That. Very successful one.
Yeah. He shot High Noon. He got a Golden Globe for it. He had an Oscar from earlier. He was good. I thought that I would want to be an actor. Actors get girls. I found out that in order to attract the attention of a young lady, being an actor, you had to have actually been in a film which she had seen. And that could take years. Whereas, if you went down to the coffee house and looked properly mournful and sang a Joan Baez song, it could happen tonight.
And just to get back to your dad, Floyd Crosby, he made more than 100 movies. Were you aware of what he was doing?
Oh, yeah.
Did he take you onto the sets?
Oh, yeah. I was watching him make movies before I could spell movie. I watched a lot of it after I learned, you know, that when they said, quiet on the set, they meant it.
And he was working with Roger Corman a lot as well, wasn't he?
Well, Roger Corman saved my dad in a very odd way. My dad got sort of brushed with the edge of the blacklist, not really central, you know, but he was really friends with Fred Zinnemann and some of the other European guys. So he thought, well, he must be one of them damn pinkos. So he didn't work. Now, this is a guy who already had an Oscar, and all of a sudden he couldn't get a job. Roger Corman reached out to him and asked him to shoot these six-week wonders that Roger was famous for. A lot of the Edgar Allan Poe stuff, The Fall of House of Usher, Pit and the Pendulum, and so forth. They weren't great movies, but my dad could make them look like a real movie. And, of course, Roger just said, oh, give me that man. And so he kind of put food on our table.
Does he play any role in the influencing of the song Cowboy Movie on If I Could Only Remember My Name? Because a lot of the lyrics on the album are quite impressionistic, and that one is a narrative story about a bunch of outlaws who are setting off for the hideout after robbing the train, and then they meet the young Indian girl.
No.
Knew that answer was coming.
He knew that was coming. Actually, Cowboy Movie is the story of the first of the number of times that CSNY broke up. We used to break up and reform about once a week. That song, If You Know Who's Who, is the story of that breakup.
Yeah, because there are four characters in that song,
yes,
that all have
actually
their
five.
Say.
There's another. I can tell you who the Indian girl was.
Yeah, the Indian girl who everybody suspects as being a little bit dodgy, and she turns out at the end of the song to be the law.
Yes, but she was the law of averages. Not the Police.
Not the Police.
However, I sing it as if she was the Police.
Have you, you never named them? You've never spelled it out? Is it you just leave it for us to work out?
Yeah.
And who's the Indian girl then?
Rita Coolidge.
Rita Coolidge? Who was in a relationship with Graham Nash at the time or not? Or was that later?
I can't get too specific about this. But she is a lovely woman and a great singer and an Indian.
Right, of course, yeah. And this room full of people we have here know all the lyrics to the song, so they're all sitting here at the moment trying to work out. Do you know who's who if you think this through? Well, I mean, does anybody think they know who the characters are? A lot of nodding going on here in the room. Yeah.
Well, I'll sing it to you, and you get one more chance to figure it out. Well.
For contractual reasons, we're unable to include complete songs in our downloads. But if you'd like to hear the full version of this and other songs recorded during the sessions, head to the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website.
Eli said, let's take her back to the cabin. I said, you don't know, she might be the law. And he said, smiling kind of nasty. It ain't too damn likely she beat me to the draw.
Next question is from Hugh Walter, works as a surveyor for a wood stove company. He says he brought his first Crosby, Stills and Nash album on the day of release. Hugh.
Sometimes this Canadian guy plays with you. Are these times entirely at Neil's whim, or do you invite him?
He's always invited, and he knows it. He, as he says, and will tell you if he were here, he would say, I follow my muse. CSN is a very good combination. When you add Neil to it, it's like adding nitroglycerin. It's a joy to do, man. The cat is a consummate writer, musician, singer.
And just to get you back to that explosive metaphor when Neil is like nitroglycerin, do you talk about his personality or his guitar playing?
Is there a difference?
Now, the reason I ask about the guitar playing is, I mean, the way that we're sitting here at Maida Vale facing the audience at the moment, and I'm sitting to your left, and you asked me to sit on this side of you because you can hear better on this side, and you blamed Neil Young for this configuration tonight.
Thank you so much. You know, I don't think it's just Neil. Neil plays a lot, but, you know, I feel gratitude towards the guy. I have no enmity for him about anything.
June Page has emailed in a question. She says, David, do you ever have writer's block? And if so, how do you cope with it?
I have, but I don't see it that way. You know, the muse comes when the muse comes and sits on your head, you know. All you can do is say thank you when it comes and have the door open. I don't really believe in it. I think it has to do with where you are in your own head and if you're willing to pick that guitar up, sit down at that keyboard. I've had many times in the space between wake and sleep, as I'm nodding off, something would click, and I'd have to snap the light on and grab up anything, envelope, and start scribbling lyrics.
And do you wake up from dreams as well and write them down, or is it always in that semi-state of falling asleep?
I lose my dreams within seconds of waking, but I have woken up. I remember waking up about 200 miles off the coast of California in the middle of the night. There was something there, and I grabbed the pad that I keep there, and I started scribbling, and I wrote Shadow Captain. Wrote the whole thing. Got down to the end, and I'm singing to myself, Shadow Captain of a charcoal ship, trying to give the light the slip. And I'm like, Cross, you are cool. And you just have to be open for it. And I cannot explain to you how the process works, but I know I am incredibly grateful that it happens to me, even to this day, regularly.
Next question comes from Jeremy Fellman, who is a London cabbie and a birds fanatic, which gives us some clue as to what his question might be about.
Three-part question. Would there be any chance of a birds reunion? And have you jammed or spoken with Roger and Chris in the last few years? And what is your favourite birds song?
Roger and Chris, we should just explain. Roger McGuinn, you're talking about, and Chris Hillman. And the answer may be...
The answer is, let's go backwards, 8 miles high, because it was such an envelope stretcher. Now, have I asked Roger? Repeatedly. I have begged Roger.
To get the birds back together.
Yeah, and I don't do a lot of begging. I would love, dearly love, you know, to sing with him and Chris. What Roger says, and I believe him, I guess, is that he's happy doing what he's doing. I can't make him do it. I would do it at the drop of a hat. You understand, my job in that band is very different. I'm not the central issue. Roger McGuinn was at least 50% of the birds. At least. What I was his wingman. And I'm good at it. And I think there's still music to be made there.
So you want to do it for musical reasons, because you think there could be something fresh.
Yeah.
Not for the nostalgia thing, not for the reason that a lot of fans would just see you
on stage
together.
I like all of that. I love it. And there's so many people out there who would be so thrilled to hear that stuff live. Roger's good. He's really good. But I can't make him do it, man. I would love to.
There you go, Jeremy. Sorry with that. Bad news. And the next question is from Sean Cohen.
Hi, David. Thank you so much. You were the voice that awakened me as a teenager in America in 1970, 71, 72.
Thanks.
My question is, which one song from your vast catalog of songs do you think could most successfully rouse the youth of today to get out there and make the world a better place? Just like, really, you did in the 60s and 70s.
It's probably a song I haven't written yet. And, well, I do have one set of words called Part of the Machine that'll be me taking a swing at them again. I'm not going to roll over and put my paws in the air and say, okay, you win.
But Sean there is talking about writing songs that rouse the youth of today. Now, you're in pretty good shape, David, but you're not part of the youth anymore. Do you expect the young people to listen to your songs still, or are you writing more for your generation?
You know, it really depends on their taste. A lot of them are into just groove dance music, you know, up all night to get lucky. Which is, okay, I know, it's witless, but it grooves so hard you can't stand still to it. And there are a lot of kids, that's really what they want. They want, yeah, up all night to get that. They love it. And you can't fault them for it. It's fun.
But do you worry the younger generation are not being handed the baton and doing the sort of thing that you were doing in the late 60s,
early 70s?
Well,
there's a key factor here that most people don't point at, and that's the draft. One of the largest reasons that we were so big at fighting the war was that every college campus was a hotbed of unrest because all those kids were facing the draft.
And you expect to be reaching those younger ears, do you?
I expect, I hope. I made the music because I have to make music. It's what I do, you know, it's my life.
Does it weigh heavily on you when you're having to think back over the back catalogue? When you're thinking, well, I wrote Long Time Gone, Almost Cut My Hair, Guinevere, all of these songs. Do you look back and think, can I hit those peaks? Does it worry you at all or not?
The truth is, I don't look back at all. People ask me about Woodstock. I can't even remember. Possibly there was a reason for that. But
you must remember something about Woodstock. What's the abiding memory of Woodstock?
A lot of good music. Yeah. A lot of great music got played. I mean, these were all our heroes. People that we truly thought were the best were standing in a row behind us as we walked out there for our second gig. And going, okay, pretty good record. Let's see what they can do live. I don't really look back much. I am mostly about what I can do today, now, and what I might be up to tomorrow, which would be this. I'll just play a piece of it.
It's a work in progress.
I don't think I'm done yet. I mean, you know, I could have three fatal diseases, none of which they have a cure for, and I'm old. But I don't feel old, and I don't feel like I'm done.
That's all we've time for in this edition of Master Tapes. We're going to go out with some music. Thanks to our audience here at the BBC Studios at Maida Vale. Thanks for all of your questions. And most of all, thanks to David Crosby. You can download both parts of this edition of Master Tapes along with all previous editions of the series. Go to the Master Tapes pages on the Radio 4 website, where you'll also find exclusive content, including full versions of the songs played live here at Maida Vale and videos of many of our Master Tapes guests. And you can tweet us using the hashtag Master Tapes. But we leave you now with David Crosby and band playing us out with a real classic. This is long time gone, isn't it?
Okay.
Remember, you can find the full version of this and other songs recorded during our live sessions on the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website, along with photographs, videos, and the other editions of the series.